This episode is brought to you by Sterling Soap Company. Fellas, you've heard the phrase, look good, feel good, right? But why not add smell good to that too? That's where Sterling Soap Company comes in. First, Sterling Soap is 100% natural and has a wide variety of bath soaps, shave soaps, beard balm, lotions, and cologne. Second, there's a scent just for you. How about burgundy? Yeah, it's more than a color. The Sterling Soap folks blend natural essential oils with hints of mahogany, golden amber, and sandalwood. Or how about D503, an intensely masculine scent inspired by Legend by Mont Blanc. And third, you will feel good about the price. For just a little more than you'd pay at the grocery store, Sterling Soap will leave you feeling clean, refreshed, and ready for whatever's next. Give Sterling Soap a try today. Visit sterlingsoap.com. This day in sports history. It's May 1st, and on this day in 1994, tragedy in Formula One racing as Ayrton Senna died during a race in Italy. It was the third weekend on the Formula One schedule. Michael Schumacher had won the first two races of the season with his Benetton team. The series was in Italy for the San Marino Grand Prix. They were racing this week at Imola, a track known for being fast, narrow, and dangerous. And this weekend would soon become known as the Black Weekend. On Friday, another driver and close friend of Senna, Rubens Barrichello, was involved in a horrible crash during practice when his car went airborne and slammed into a tire wall. He was knocked out, but fortunately survived, suffering a broken nose, a broken arm, along with minor cuts and bumps. On Saturday, a rookie driver named Roland Ratzenberger was killed during the second qualifying session. Senna actually hopped in a safety car to check on Ratzenberger and was criticized for doing so. But he wanted information, and Senna felt like information was slow in coming from Formula One, or it was just being withheld. It took several hours for news of Ratzenberger's death to reach the garage. Ratzenberger had actually died in his race car on the racetrack, but he was removed from his car and transported to a local hospital where he was then pronounced dead. The reason that's important is that under Italian law, an on-track death during a race weekend would have halted all events until the accident could be investigated. The race would have been canceled. A lot of money would have been lost. By pronouncing him dead at the hospital, racing activities could continue at the track. Ratzenberger's death was the first F1 racing fatality in 12 years. Also, Senna was with a new team this season, having left McLaren, where he had won 3 Formula One championships, to join the Williams racing team. Williams had the power he felt was lacking at McLaren, but due to an off-season ruling by F1 removing some of the technology from the cars, well, he felt like the cars lacked control. In the first two races, he had yet to claim any points. At his home track in Brazil, he spun out and crashed while leading. He was frustrated. On this day, race day, Senna was on the pole. Schumacher was outside. At the drop of the green flag, there was an immediate problem, though. A car on the grid several rows behind Senna and Schumacher stalled, and another driver plowed into the back of him, bringing out an immediate yellow and the safety car. This first crash was so bad that a security officer and 8 race fans were injured from the flying debris as a result of the impact of the crash. Senna was not happy for a lot of reasons, but he got frustrated at the safety driver for driving too slow. Senna felt the heat leaving his tires. Hotter tires are grippier tires. The safety car pulled off the track on lap 5 for the restart of the race. On lap 7, entering the left-hand Tamburello turn, Senna lost control of his race car, went off the track to the right, and crashed into the outside wall at 131 miles per hour. When paramedics arrived on the scene, Senna was alive, but with a very low pulse. The chief medical officer that day was Dr. Sid Watkins. He said he raised his eyelids, and it was clear from Senna's pupils that he had a massive brain injury. He went on to say, "We lifted him from the cockpit and laid him on the ground. As we did, he sighed, and, although I am not religious, I felt his spirit depart at that moment." Senna was flown to a nearby hospital, but was pronounced brain dead at 6:40 p.m. local time. News of Senna's condition was held until after the completion of the race. Schumacher won his third race in 3 starts, but on the podium, there was no celebration, no champagne popping, no music. After being given the news of Senna, the race results were announced, and the drivers walked somberly off the podium. An investigation into the crash later determined that the impact caused his front right tire and suspension to break away from his car. A fragment of the suspension pierced Senna's helmet, causing a skull fracture and severe brain injury, resulting in his death. Several safety measures came about as a result of Senna's death. By 1999, FIA incorporated higher cockpit sides to protect drivers' heads from impact. Tethers were added to the wheels to prevent them from detaching. Additional runoff areas at tracks were put in to help reduce the car's speed once they left the track. And efforts were put in place to slow the cars down while on the track. Ayrton Senna, a 3-time Formula One champion, died at the age of 34. Also on this day, in 1920, it was the longest Major League Baseball game by innings in history, as the Boston Braves and the Brooklyn Robins played a total of 26 innings before darkness fell, and the game had to be halted at 1-1. Amazingly, they played 26 innings in just 3 hours, 50 minutes. And in the May 9th edition, you'll realize why that is so incredible. So, obviously, this was before lights were introduced in ballparks, and apparently the idea of relief pitching was not even a glimmer. Both the Braves' starting pitcher, Joe Esker, and the Dodgers' Leon Cador pitched all 26 innings. Neither pitcher allowed a run over the last 20 innings. Esker actually pitched a 9-inning no-hitter. It just wasn't the first 9. More impressively, though, is that it was his final 9 innings. Esker also set a record that day, pitching 21 consecutive scoreless innings in a game, and said that pitching all those innings was really about job security. He told a reporter from the Sarasota Herald Tribune decades later, "If a pitcher couldn't go the distance, well, he soon found himself some other form of occupation." Both Esker and Cador pitched out of jams throughout, and each pitcher got inning-ending double plays with the bases loaded. The game did take a toll on both guys, though. Esker couldn't lift his arm to brush his teeth, so he had to do it with his left. Cador is said to have slept the better part of the next 2 days recuperating from his effort. The game was never restarted, and officially it's a 1-1 tie. Interestingly, these two teams met at the same park 19 seasons later and played to a 2-2 tie in 23 innings. And in 1991, it was another Herculean pitching performance as Nolan Ryan pitched his 7th career no-hitter. At this point in his career, Ryan was a 44-year-old veteran playing for the Texas Rangers. On this night, the Rangers were celebrating Arlington Appreciation Night with the Toronto Blue Jays in town, and the early 90s Blue Jays had a stout lineup. This was Ryan's 25th season in the majors, and he showed he still had zip on his fastball. He was able to mix in a changeup every now and again, along with a hard-breaking curveball. Ryan struck out 16, including Roberto Alomar, to end the game, and he only walked 2 on his way to the 3-0 win. So when Ryan had pitched his 6th no-hitter the season before, he had become the oldest to ever throw a no-hitter, so his 7th simply topped his own record. He managed to strike out at least 1 batter each inning, and this was his 26th game of striking out 15 or more. So Nolan's 7th career no-hitter stole a lot of the spotlight from a guy who loved the bright glare of notoriety, because also on this day in 1991, on the West Coast, Oakland's Ricky Henderson became the all-time leading base stealer in Major League history. In the 4th inning, and Henderson on 2nd, he took a confident lead and then took off when New York Yankees pitcher Tim Leary delivered to the plate. Henderson slid headfirst into third, and the throw from Matt Noakes was a little late, and it was steal number 939. Henderson jumped up, pulled the base out of the ground, and held it above his head to celebrate passing Lou Brock as the all-time base stealer. There was a brief on-field celebration as Brock himself congratulated Henderson. Brock set his mark in 19 seasons. Henderson was able to break the record in his 13th. Interesting fact, though, Henderson actually was caught stealing twice in this game. Once in the first inning in his first attempt to break the record, and again in the fifth. Time now for today's non-sports Did You Know? On this day in 1953, Sheridan, Wyoming had to cancel its annual snow festival because there was too much snow. That's all for today. Check back in tomorrow for another edition of This Day in Sports History. This has been an original Thrive Suite production.
Hey there, Sports History fans.
We've got some exciting news to share with you. Six of our podcasts from the Sports History Network have made it to the final round of voting for the prestigious Sports Podcast Awards. Here are their shows and the categories. Historically Speaking Sports and This Day in Sports History are both competing for Best Sports Talk Podcast. No Nonsense Old School Weightlifting History is in the running for Best Fitness, Health, and Well-Being Podcast. When Football Was Football is up for Best Sports Documentary Podcast. Wrestling with Heels On has entered the ring for Best Wrestling Podcast. And Shoulder Roll Virtual Boxing is fighting for the title for Best Combat Sports Podcast. Now, of course, we need your help to take home the championship for each of these awesome shows. All you gotta do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/vote, cast your vote for your favorite shows, or better yet, all six of them. Again, every vote counts, and we gotta show the world how much sports history really matters. So thank you for your support and making Sports History Network the headquarters for sports yesteryear. But again, don't wait. You got to go vote now. That's over at sportshistorynetwork.com/vote.